Okay, welcome once again. This is Richard Clem doing a CLE today on Conflicts of Interest, Part 3. Today is January 20th, 2016. We're doing it as a live conference call, and we're also recording it for the future podcast. We're going to pick up in the written materials, the section marked Other Related Rules. The first one we're going to talk about is the rule governing confidentiality, Rule 1.6 of the rules of professional conduct. The reason why I put this in as a related rule is because conflicts of interest, you don't really look at it in a vacuum. You have to have two interests that are in conflict, and more often than not, the conflict or the interest that you have to consider is your duty of confidentiality that you owe to one or more clients. So it's important to look at that, and it's a very broad rule, as you can see, because it's written as kind of an absolute. It basically says that everything that takes place in the practice of law is confidential. Because the rule states that you shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client, ever, period. So it's like I say, more or less an absolute rule. Note, it does not say confidential information. It does not say privileged information. It just says that you may never reveal information relating to the representation of a client unless you can show that it fits in one of the exceptions that are stated in the rule. So in other words, I guess it boils down to the fact that anytime you do reveal information about a client, the burden of proof will probably be on you to show that it was a legitimate purpose. So like I say, it's written in terms of an absolute with some exceptions. The first exception, of course, is if the client consents to it. Just about anything can be consented to. So if the client consents to you revealing the information, that's okay. But the most important exception to the rule, the one where it would come into play most often, would be that you can, of course, reveal information if it's impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. Because, of course, that's what you are being hired to do when a client hires you. You're being hired to communicate information to other people. You're to communicate to the opposing side and to the judge and to the jury and whoever else you need to communicate it to. But because the rule is worded this way, like I say, it kind of shows that the burden of proof will be on you. So if you reveal information that is not necessary to carry out the representation, then that's a violation of the rule. So like I say, it's expressed in very absolute terms. This rule goes on to talk about what your obligations are if you have information showing that your client is going to commit a crime. And if we have time at the end of the hour, we'll come back and talk about that a little bit. If you want to know more about that, we covered that in detail in last year's ethics program. So the 2015 podcast goes into detail about that. But basically, your obligation, depending on your state, whether this is mandatory or permissive, is to reveal the information if it's necessary to prevent your client from committing a serious crime. One resulting in death, serious bodily injury, or substantial financial or property loss. Other than that, those are the only exceptions stated here. You can that one very limited exception if your client is about to commit a crime, or like I say, information necessary to carry out the representation, or unless it's consented to. Now, note that this rule is not talking about the attorney-client privilege. The attorney-client privilege is actually a very narrow rule that in certain limited situations you cannot be compelled to testify against your client, or not against your client, but you cannot be compelled to reveal information that was provided to you that was privileged. But that's actually a pretty narrow area. Push comes to shove, if the grand jury orders you to testify about what your client told you, it's very possible that the privilege would not apply. if the grand jury is not asking you to reveal this information, it would be a violation of your client's confidentiality. It would be a violation of Rule 1.6 to reveal anything about the representation. And I should note that stated in the rule is that one exception to confidentiality is if the court orders you to provide information, because it's not a violation to provide information about your representation to comply with a law or court order. Nor is it a violation to reveal information to secure legal advice about your conduct under the rules. So if you do have to call the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility or the Wisconsin State Bar Association to ask them, you know, what do I do in this situation? Or even if you just informally ask a colleague about what you think your obligations are with respect to some other ethical quandary that comes up, that is also an exception. You can reveal the information to the extent necessary to secure legal advice. But other than that, everything that takes place in the practice of law is confidential and needs to be treated as such. Well, moving on, Rule 1.7 is the one that we spent the first 2 hours talking about, the rule that simply says that you shall not engage in conflicts of interest. In some cases, well, because we spent 2 hours talking about it, I guess we could say that in all cases that might be difficult to figure out exactly what your obligations are. But there are some special cases specified in Rule 1.8 that tell what your obligations are in some certain limited situations. There are very specific rules covering very specific situations. Some of these might be common, but most of these are very very unusual circumstances that probably don't come up too often. But Rule 1.8 does provide some very specific guidance in some specific situations. The first thing the Rule 1.8 talks about is says that you shall not enter into a transaction with a client where you acquire an interest adverse to your client, such as, for example, a security interest, or such as you owing your client money, or such as your client owing money to you, because then you have instantly have an adverse relationship with your client. Well, of course, there are some situations where that's necessary. I guess just in just about every case where you work for the client owes you money, so you have an adverse interest to your client, at least to that extent. So the rule does provide an exception that you know, such conflicts of interest can be consented to, and in order for this rule to apply, if you do have an interest adverse to your client, so if you're engaged in you know, some separate business transaction with the client, or perhaps you have a security interest in your client's property to secure payment of your bill or something like that, that is permissible if the client consents to it. But the following also has to apply. First of all, the transaction has to be fair and reasonable, so you can't take unfair advantage of your client in that situation. The client has to give written consent, so that consent has to be in writing. And this is a part of the rule where one attorney who took the program a few years ago told me that he got himself into a little bit of trouble because the rule says that the client must be advised in writing to obtain outside legal advice. So you have to write to your client, you know, before entering into this transaction with me, I hereby advise you in writing that it would be a good idea for you to obtain outside legal advice before signing this contract with me. The client doesn't actually have to get the outside legal advice, but you have to advise them in writing that it's a good idea. And how one attorney got himself into a little bit of trouble inadvertently violating this rule was that he was employed by as the general counsel, or at least he was an attorney for a family business owned by his wife's parents. So his wife's parents owned the widget factory or whatever, and they employed him as their attorney. And for that reason, his in-laws, in addition to being his in-laws, were also his client. And during the course of the marriage, the in-laws loaned money or something to the couple to make the down payment on a house or something like that. Perfectly normal transaction. But as a result of that transaction, he was entering into this business contract with his client, where he acquired an adverse interest to them. He owed them money. As it turned out, the marriage apparently wasn't meant to last, and it wound up in the divorce courts, and it apparently turned into a nasty divorce where all kinds of accusations were being thrown back and forth. And at some point, the in-laws got the idea to file a complaint with the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. So they marched into that office and said that they want to file a complaint against their attorney, and it was for violation of this rule because he entered into a transaction with them where he acquired an adverse interest. Well, the transaction was fair and reasonable. They had to concede that, and they probably even at some point gave something that qualified as written consent. But unfortunately for the hapless lawyer, he had never advised his in-laws in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice. And rules are rules, so the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility had to enforce that rule, and he wound up with a private reprimand. Now, they kept it a private reprimand because I think they understandably figured out that they were just getting sucked into the fallout from a nasty divorce, and they probably didn't enjoy that too much. But like I say, rules are rules, and he violated that one. So what he should have done was sent a thank you note to his in-laws saying, thank you for loaning us this money. This will make our marriage last forever, and we can't tell you how much we thank you. But by the way, I hereby advise you in writing about the need to obtain outside legal advice. If he would have done that, he would have been okay, but unfortunately he neglected to do that, so he wound up with a private reprimand. At this point, for our podcast listeners, I'm going to go ahead and give the first of today's code numbers. The first code number is E, as in ethics, 803. E-803. E-803 is the first code word for our podcast listeners today. So, again, turning back to Rule 1.8, if you enter into a business transaction, you better make sure that you have the proper scrap of paper filed away in your records saying that you advised the client that they need to get outside legal advice. Here's an issue that doesn't come up too often what if your client wants to give you a substantial gift? So your millionaire client is sitting across the desk from you and says, you've been such a good lawyer here, I'm going to give you $1 million. That's perfectly okay. That would be a good thing to happen, and you can gratefully accept that gift. But what you're not allowed to do is two things. First of all, you are not allowed to solicit a substantial gift. So you cannot, if you're sitting across the table from your client, you cannot say, boy, it sure would be nice if you gave me a substantial gift today, because that would be a violation of this rule. But more importantly, what you're not allowed to do is draft the instrument that puts that gift into effect, such as a deed or even a check. Your client can't literally give you a blank check because then you're filling in the instrument. But more commonly where the issue comes up is drafting a will. You cannot draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary unless, and there are some exceptions to this that vary a little bit from state to state, even if you're in a state that seemingly accepts it, you shouldn't do it, which is why I'll explain in a little while. There is an exception if the person giving you the gift is a relative. So if you're if you're drafting a will for a close relative, for parents or siblings or something like that, yes, you can name yourself as a beneficiary. And in Minnesota and Iowa, in doing so, you will not get yourself disbarred. So that's good news. Now, the Wisconsin rule is a little bit different. And for those of you taking it in different states, I want you to pay attention to the Wisconsin rule anyway, because as we'll see, this rule is kind of applicable to you as well. But for those of you in Wisconsin, if you are drafting a will for somebody else, naming yourself as a beneficiary, then the rule is slightly different. Like in Minnesota and Iowa, and most other states, the person making the gift has to be a relative. But Wisconsin adds some language saying that that you must be the natural object of the bounty of the person making the gift. And that simply means that you are in the class of relatives who would normally get a gift of approximately this magnitude. So if you're drafting will, you know, for your fourth cousin, seven times removed, and you get the entire estate, maybe that person is a relative, but you're not the natural object of the bounty. On the other hand, if it's, drafting a will for a parent and you're the only child and you get the entire estate, well, then you probably are the natural object of the bounty. The amount of the gift has to be reasonable and natural. That's part of the test in Wisconsin. There's no reasonable ground to believe that the instrument will be contested. You can't, if there's somebody lurking out there who might contest the will, well, then you have to stay away from it entirely. And my favorite part of the test is that there can't be any possibility that the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. Because, as you know, we as attorneys are just, held in the highest of respect by everybody in society. Nobody would ever, question our integrity or tell jokes about us or anything like that. But on the other hand, some attorney drafts this will naming himself as a beneficiary, and that just ruins it for all of us. You know, people start telling lawyer jokes after hearing about that. So if there's any possibility of that happening, then you are in violation of this Wisconsin rule, and you will get yourself disbarred. Because the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. So like I say, that's the Wisconsin rule. It's a lot more strict. But those of us in Minnesota and Iowa and other states would be well served to keep the Wisconsin rule in mind because that arcane language that I just quoted, natural object of the bounty, and all that stuff, that's taken from some, 1840 common law case. And it is probably similar to the test that will be employed by a probate court in Minnesota or Iowa or just about any other state. So in Minnesota, you draft this will and you name yourself as the beneficiary because the person was a relative. You're not going to get yourself disbarred for doing that because the person was a relative. That's the end of the test in Minnesota. But on the other hand, when the case gets before the probate court, the probate court is going to be employing this Wisconsin test. And the probate judge is going to have to figure out whether or not you're the natural object of the bounty. And the probate judge is going to have to figure out whether the public will lose confidence in the integrity of the bar. And those are not particularly objective standards. So in other words, if the probate judge simply doesn't like you, then the probate judge is going to have a lot of ammunition to rule against you. So the moral of the story is that even for attorneys in Minnesota and Iowa and other states, you would be well served never to draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary. Because even though there are some rare situations where it might be permissible, you probably don't want to run that risk. So the short version of today's program, I would just say never draft a will naming yourself as a beneficiary, but that is why. Another issue that doesn't come up too often in my practice of law, but let's say the next O.J. Simpson case takes place in Milwaukee, and the defendant walks into your office and says, "Can you represent me in this this high-profile case, but I don't have any money to pay you, but I have this, you know, I already have all these book and movie offers starting to roll in, so I can't pay you, but I can sign you over the movie rights arising out of my case. Well, you can't do that because until a case is concluded, you may not receive literary rights based upon the representation. And the reason for that rule is because once your client has signed over those literary rights, then you have a very different interest in the case than your client does. Because at that point, your client just wants to get off. You, on the other hand, want to make the case as exciting as possible so that it will be a blockbuster movie. So the rule simply says that you can never do that until the case is concluded. So I guess, once the case is over and you, you visit your client and hand him the bill, and he says, well, I can't pay you because I'm in prison now, but I can sign you over the movie rights. Well, I guess at that point it's okay because then there's nothing more you're going to do in the case to make it more or less exciting. The next part of the rule probably comes up a little bit more often than that one, and now you have this black and white rule that you can point to whenever anybody asks you, because you are not allowed to provide financial assistance to your client. No matter how much of a hard luck story your client shows you. So if your client says, boy, you know, I need money to pay the rent this month. Can you help me out? You point to this and you say, well, I would love to help you, but unfortunately, you know, Rule 1.8 of the Rules of Professional Conduct prohibit me from doing so. So it's not my fault and I'm not going to help you. It's the state bar's fault. But you can't provide financial assistance to a client. And there is an exception for costs of litigation, and if you are advancing costs of litigation, you better read the rule carefully because there are some requirements regarding that. We talked about this other one a little bit earlier in the context of the insurance defense lawyer, but it can arise in other contexts as well. It is permissible for somebody other than the client to pay your fee, and that happens a lot. You're representing one person, but some other person is actually paying the bill for the representation. That's permissible, but only if all these requirements are met. So it can arise in the two most common situations where it would arise would be the insurance defense context. So you are representing somebody who's getting sued for something that's covered by an insurance policy. So the insurance company is paying your bill. But the client is still the client. Another common situation where it arises is the criminal defense context, because oftentimes criminal defendants don't have any money to pay you. That's probably why they were criminals in the first place. So some third party is paying the fee, and as one criminal defense attorney explained to me, that person is known as Mom. So he's representing Junior, who's charged with a crime, and Mom is paying his bill. Well, that's perfectly acceptable, as long as first of all the client has to consent. And there's an exception in Wisconsin if you're a public defender. You're paid by at government expense, maybe they don't have to consent in that case. But generally, the client has to consent. Wisconsin adds an interesting provision that is useful to the insurance defense attorneys to clarify a situation. What if the defendant says, no, I don't want the insurance company paying you? Now, that puts you in kind of a difficult situation, except in Wisconsin, you can point to this rule and say that the consent does not necessarily have to be contemporaneous. It's sufficient that they consented back when they originally bought the insurance policy, and they don't have to re-consent again today. And I suspect a Minnesota court would probably rule the same way if the issue came up, but in Wisconsin, the rule is specified. But anyway, the client has to consent. If you're visiting Junior in the jail cell and, you say, is it okay if Mom pays my bill? Well, he'll probably say yes. But you do need to get that consent. But more importantly, the representation can't interfere with your independence and you have to treat the confidential information properly. In other words, the client is still the client, even though some third party is paying your bill. The person paying your bill does not necessarily have any say as to how you conduct the case, nor do they have any access to information about the case. Their role in the case is simply to pay the bills, not to tell you what to do or not to get information. Now, the person paying the bill doesn't necessarily always understand this. Well, the insurance company understands it, but mom probably doesn't understand it when she's paying the bill for Junior. And this criminal defense attorney told me that it is a quite common situation for the mother who's paying the bill to come to him and say something like, "Well, you know, I don't want my son to get in serious trouble, but I want him to learn a lesson. So I want you to make sure that he gets at least 30 days. Well, no, you can't do that, because if the client comes to you and says, you know, I want to learn my lesson. Can you see to it that I get at least 30 days in jail? Well, then you have to respect that wish. But if the son says that he doesn't want 30 days, and the mom says that she does want 30 days, well, you have to go with the son, notwithstanding the fact that mom is writing the checks. The people writing the checks don't always understand that rule. So the practical advice is that you need to get paid up front in those cases, because when they realize that they don't have any say over how you're conducting the case, they might pay you. So in those situations, you want to probably get paid in advance. The next rule probably isn't necessary to be in the rules, but it reiterates a point that if you're representing more than one party, so if you're representing two plaintiffs or you're representing two defendants, then any aggregate settlement of the case obviously has to be approved by all of the clients. And I was always kind of wondering why they put that in there, but then one attorney taking the program who explained to me that it's to clarify and make clear a situation that comes up pretty often in her practice of law, because she her practice of law involves representing government entities such as, you know, cities or counties who are getting sued for various things, such as, for example, a police officer being accused of excessive force, or a city manager who is accused of discrimination or something. Well, what happens pretty frequently in her practice of law, something that that comes up, is that in those situations, two people get sued. The individual police officer is getting sued, and the city is getting sued. What happens fairly frequently is, the plaintiff's attorney might figure out that, well, I guess this case isn't quite as good as I thought it was going to be. We were suing for $3.8 million, but well, there are a few little problems with the case. So he comes to the city council and says, well, you know, we'll settle the case for $10,000. So we'll go away. The city council will probably grudgingly go along with that, because they'll realize that the cost of litigation is going to be much more than that, and there's always a risk that the jury will misunderstand the case and bring back a verdict of $3.8 million anyway. More often than not, the city council will grudgingly go along with that and say, okay, here's a check. We'll settle the case for $10,000. The individual officer, though, who is accused of doing something wrong, who thinks he didn't do anything wrong, will more often than not say, no, I'm not going to agree to this settlement because I want my day in court. I didn't do anything wrong. And then the lawyer tries to explain, well, but it's not costing you anything. You know, the city is paying the whole thing. He says, no, I still demand my right to go to a trial. This rule makes clear that, yes, that person does have the right to do that. The case can't be settled until all the defendants sign off on it. Understandably, that causes a little bit of consternation in her practice of law. And it also means that, well, at that point, it probably is a conflict of interest. which kind of shows that maybe in that situation, it would probably be better to have separate attorneys representing both of them. But like I say, that that might cause a little bit of consternation in that particular practice area. But that's what the rule is. All the parties have to consent to that aggregate settlement. One thing that you must never do is ask your client to prospectively waive a malpractice claim. Whether or not you're guilty of malpractice, or even it doesn't say that the client has to agree to it, or it doesn't say that such an agreement is unenforceable. The rule says that it's a violation of the rules to simply ask your client. So never ask your client to waive malpractice claims because it's unenforceable, and it's also a violation of this rule. And there's an exception if they're independently represented by another attorney, so that probably doesn't come into play too often. But never ask your client to prospectively waive malpractice claims. They put the word prospective in there because once a claim is made and you settle the claim, the client has to sign off saying, I'm accepting this money as settlement of my malpractice claim, and I'm waiving the claim that I could pursue against you. But you can't do it prospectively. And also, you must never ask your client not to turn you in to the disciplinary authorities. So never say to a client, please don't call the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility or the state bar or whoever regulates lawyers in your state, because simply asking that is a violation of the rule. Again, even if you didn't do anything wrong. So if you honestly and truthfully say, please don't turn me in because I didn't do anything wrong. Well, that's a violation of the rule because you're telling them not to report you to disciplinary authorities. So never say that. And certainly never put anything in your retainer agreement saying that, client hereby agrees not to sue for malpractice. Because, like I say, it's a violation simply to ask them to sign that, whether or not they do. You should never acquire a proprietary interest in a cause of action. So with two exceptions, one, a reasonable contingent fee in a civil case. So if you have a contingent fee that otherwise complies with Rule 1.5, that's okay. And the other exception is an attorney's lien, which doesn't come up too often, but in the Minnesota statutes and in the Wisconsin statutes, there is a provision relating to attorney's liens. And you do indeed have a proprietary interest in every cause of action that you ever work on, but that attorney's lien does not represent a violation of the rules. And then the final rule covered by Rule 1.8 says that a lawyer may not have sexual relations with a client unless that relationship predated the legal representation. In the case of a corporate client, that means the person supervising the attorney. Now, we will talk in a minute about imputed disqualification, imputed conflicts of interest, but the general rule is, with the exception of that last paragraph, but in general, the conflict of interest rules apply to all attorneys in your firm. So in other words, if you have a conflict of interest, well, then so does your partner, and so does your associate, and so does your boss. Conflicts of interest run with the firm, not with the individual attorneys. And like I say, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a couple of minutes. But before we do, we already talked about this a little bit yesterday, I think, your duties to a former client. We talked about who a former client was yesterday, but I guess we'll take a look at the rule here saying what your duties are to your former clients. Obviously, you can't represent a former client in the same or substantially related matter, or you can't represent somebody against a client in the same or substantially similar matter. So, in other words, you can't change sides in the middle of the litigation. Basically, these situations are resolved in terms of confidential information because remember, under Rule 1.6, basically everything that you learned in the course of your representation is confidential, and you can never use that confidential information against your client in the future. So you probably cannot have cases against your former clients, period, although there might be some rare situations where that you know, that confidential information has become so attenuated over time or something. But in general, you can't have cases against former clients because that duty of confidentiality persists forever. And at this point, I'm going to give the second code number for our podcast listeners. The second code number for today's program is E-862. E-862 is the second code word for today's program. Well, as promised, we're going to talk about imputed disqualification. And as I mentioned previously, the general rule is that disqualification runs with the firm. So if you are disqualified from taking a case, so is every other attorney in your firm. And so that's a pretty simple rule to state. Rule 1.10, though, goes into more detail because it talks about how that affects your future employment prospects. So, in other words, what happens when you change jobs? Well, what happens when you change jobs is that your conflicts of interest come with you to your new employment as your personal baggage. So let's say, for example, you decide to hire me as a new associate to work in your office. And I, being from Minnesota, I worked hypothetically for our, one of our state's largest employers, 3M. So I was an in-house attorney for 3M, and 3M is my former client. And because they're my former client, I can't take cases against 3M. So if somebody comes to me and wants to sue 3M, I have to tell them, well, I'm sorry, that's my former client, and I have a conflict of interest. You'll have to find another attorney. I come to work for you. And then one day, hypothetically, somebody hobbles into your office, and an injured plaintiff or a plaintiff-to-be, and they were injured because of a defective Post-it note, because it turns out hypothetically that 3M has been putting toxic waste on their Post-it notes. So to dispose of all their toxic waste, they put them on the Post-it notes and kind of kills two birds with one stone because it's sticky toxic waste. But anyway, this plaintiff was horribly injured by this egregious practice of distributing toxic waste. And they come into your office and they want to sue 3M. And they have a multi-million dollar case because it's this huge conspiracy was going on. So anyway, they come into your office with this multi-million dollar case against 3M. And you just hired me, the former attorney for 3M. So you think about this for a couple seconds, and you start telling them, I'm sorry, we can't take your case because we have a conflict of interest, so you'll have to take your lucrative case elsewhere. But you think just a little bit before you talk and say, you think to yourself, what's more important to the future of my law firm? Is it my employment relationship with Clem, or is it this potentially lucrative multi-million-dollar client who just came into the office? And you think about that for about 2 seconds, and you decide that obviously this new client is obviously a lot more important to your future than this new employee that you just hired. So you come to me and say, I'm sorry, you don't work here anymore. You go find another job somewhere else, and you fire me. Well, at that point, I pack up all the things on my desk, and I leave your office. But among the things I pack up is that baggage that I brought with me to your office, namely that conflict of interest. So once I take that conflict of interest with me as my personal baggage, that is no longer your conflict of interest. And at that point, you can take this lucrative case against my former client. So in other words, conflicts of interest are personal baggage. You bring them with you to your new job, but you also take them away with you when you leave. Now, there might be some exception, you know, if while I was working for you, you know, I told you all of the secrets about, you know, the sludge on the Post-it notes and so forth. But in general, that conflict of interest is my personal baggage. Now, there's also an exception that if I, you know, I didn't work in the toxic waste litigation department. I was in the, you know, I was in their real estate department drafting quit claim deeds when they bought a new factory or something. You know, that there might be an exception there if my work with that earlier client was minor and isolated. But in general, the conflicts of interest are imputed to you. And those conflicts of interest go when the employee goes. So conflicts of interest are your baggage. Now, that rule works well when you're dealing with private companies or private individuals trying to figure out who the former clients are. It's a little bit more difficult to – that rule really wouldn't work very well, though. If I, instead of working for 3M, I worked, you know, I was an assistant attorney general or I was a county attorney in, let's say, in Wisconsin. So I, you know, I worked in the Dane County prosecutor's office as a prosecuting attorney. You know, then I come to work for you, and you have a thriving criminal defense practice in Dane County. Well, if you literally applied Rule 1.10, well, then you could never hire me ever because, well, who's my former client? My former client was the state of Wisconsin. So that rule doesn't work too well. So that's why there's a special rule for covering the case of former government employees, and that is Rule 1.11. And 1.11 says that in the case of the former government attorney, we don't worry quite so much about who the former client was, but instead we only worry about the particular case that the attorney was working on. So if I was working for the Dane County Prosecutor's Office prosecuting John Smith, well, then I can't go to work for John Smith as his defense attorney. But on the other hand, I can go to work for your law firm, even though you are defending other criminal cases that I was not involved with. Well, even that rule might pose problems, maybe not in Dane County, but, you know, in some little county. You know, so if I'm in, you know, if I'm in Rock County, Minnesota, you know, I'm in Laverne, Minnesota, and I'm the Rock County County Attorney. Well, I don't think the Rock County Attorney's Office is particularly large. It's probably one person, probably even part time. You know, and I have prosecuted every single case in Rock County. And they're, you know, unless I want to, you know, move to another state or another county, that's going to pretty much limit my employment. If I go to work for your law firm, in Laverne, Minnesota, because, you know, every single criminal case you have, has been, one that I was personally working on. So that would still mean that you can't hire me, period. Well, the rule also makes an exception to cover that case, and it says that I can even go to work for your firm, even though I was personally prosecuting people that you are now defending. I can still work for your firm, but I have to be screened off from those cases. You are not allowed to even talk to me about those cases, and I cannot share any portion of the fee from those cases. And then presumably after a certain period of time, those cases will have worked their way out of the system, and we don't have to worry about it anymore. But I could even go to work for the firm that that was representing people I was personally prosecuting as long as I'm screened off from the case. So that's the rules for former government employees. And Rule 1.12 is basically the same rule for the case of former judges. Basically, the same rules apply to former judges. And even if you're not a former judge, Rule 1.12 might apply to you if you were ever an arbitrator or mediator in a case. You're basically in the same position as a judge. You can't represent the people whose cases you were judging, nor can you work for those firms unless you are screened off from those cases. But other than that, it's basically identical to Rule 1.11. Rule 1.11 also covers a couple of points talking about current government lawyers that are really totally separate from what we just talked about. It probably ought to be a separate rule. But what are the rules for current government employees? And the rule for current government employees is that... or former government employees, in any context, not necessarily a government attorney, but the rule says that any confidential information you learned while in the course of your government employment, not just attorney-client kind of confidentiality, but information that's confidential for any reason, you can never use that information against the person about whom you know that information later on in the practice of law. So, for example, this applies to me because once a year I become a government employee for a day. When on election day I go down to serve as an election judge. During my government employment as an election judge, I have access to certain confidential information. So, for example, I have this big book in front of me listing all the registered voters in my precinct. To some extent, that's public information, but while it's in my hands, it's basically considered to be confidential information. For example, that could be useful for me. Let's say I'm a collections attorney. I'm trying to track down these people who owe money to my clients. So I open up the voter registration book and I see here's John Doe. That's the guy I'm trying to collect this money from. And here's his address. I save that information. I cannot use that information in the private practice of law because that would be a violation of Rule 1.11 because I'm taking advantage of that confidential information. When the first Wednesday after the first Monday of November, I become a private citizen again, and when I'm a former government lawyer. So you can't use that confidential information again during your government employment. The Wisconsin rule makes clear that that a government agency is not a law firm for purpose of imputing conflicts of interest. I don't think that really needs to be said, but Wisconsin Rule 1.11 makes that clear. And as I said, Rule 1.12 talks about the duties of a former judge, including arbitrators and mediators and so forth. Okay, let's see, we have about 12 minutes left here, so I think we'll be able to blast through the rest of the material here. We talked about Rule 1.13 a little bit yesterday, talking about your specific duties when an organization is your client. Like we mentioned yesterday, if an organization is your client, well, then an organization is your client. You are not necessarily representing individuals within the organization, and your duty is always to act in the best interest of the organization, not necessarily the best interest of individuals within the organization. You do have to, when interacting with employees and officers and directors and so forth, you do need to affirmatively make sure that those people understand that you are representing the organization and you are not representing them individually. So you can't lull the scapegoat employee into a false sense of security that you're standing up for their interests when in fact you're going to make them the scapegoat. That would be a violation of this rule. Now, one interesting corollary to the fact that the organization is your client talks about your obligations if you discover illegality going on within the company. You, because of your duty of loyalty to the company, well, you have a duty to do something about that. You might have a duty to become a whistleblower. Now, hopefully, hopefully you don't work for a company where this is going to come into play, and, fortunately it doesn't come into play too often. But there might be some situations where you discover something illegal going on within your company, perhaps high up within the company. What is your obligation in that circumstance? So, for example, you discover that your employer is illegally dumping toxic waste and polluting the streams in the area doing bad stuff. But so far they haven't gotten caught. But you figured out what's going on. What is your obligation there? In one sense you could say, well, my obligation is to keep my mouth shut because I don't want to get my client in trouble. But on the other hand, that sort of thing always comes to light. Eventually somebody's going to figure out where the toxic waste is going to come from, then your client's going to be in big trouble. In fact, there's a $1 million per day fine for dumping toxic waste in your estate, and eventually your client's going to get caught. Well, your duty is to keep that from happening because you have to act in the best interest of the company, and it's not in the best interest of the company to pay a $1 million fine. So what exactly is your duty? Well, first of all, your duty is to go to the person within the organization who's responsible for that and say, stop it, because you're getting us into a lot of trouble. So you go to that person and you say, well, no, I've been told to dump the toxic waste. So you go to that person's boss. Well, that person blows you off. You go to that person's boss. You eventually, work your way up the chain of command. Eventually you tell the board of directors about the toxic waste, but they don't want to do anything about it either. At that point, you might have an obligation to call up the EPA and turn your client in. Now, I would not do that lightly. I would give it a lot of thought. I would seek some outside legal advice before doing such a thing because you are going to get your client into trouble for doing it. But it might be in your client's best interest to do it because, after all, your client, the corporation, is incurring a $1 million per day fine for doing this. But if you turn them in, well, that's going to put an end to it. So, they'll have to deal with the $1 million a day fine for yesterday, but at least they won't have this $1 million per day fine going on indefinitely into the future. So that you might have that obligation to be a whistleblower. Like I say, don't do that lightly, but that might be your ethical obligation to do that in the right case. And that obligation, interestingly, continues even after you get fired, because you go to the big boss of the company and say, hey, board of directors, they're dumping toxic waste. And they say, well, we don't want to hear about that. We have our head in the sands here. By the way, you're fired. You're a troublemaker. Get out of here. In that situation, normally when your client says you're fired, well, then you don't have any more obligations to them. You're free to go home, and you don't have to worry about that client anymore. But here, there's one exception to that rule, and that is that your duty to be a whistleblower continues even after you get fired, to the extent that you can still remedy that. So if you get fired, then you might have an obligation to go to the company president and say, I just got fired, but the reason I got fired was this illegality. Or you might even have an obligation to go to the EPA or whoever the enforcement people are and turn your client in to prevent that future wrongdoing. In that situation, you have to examine the purity of your motives. If you're saying, you know, I'm doing this to get even with them for firing me. Well, if you're saying that, then you probably shouldn't do it. But on the other hand, if you can truthfully say, I'm doing this to protect them because, you know, that was a good company and they're going to get themselves in a lot of trouble if they keep doing this, well, then it would be a different matter. So, like I say, Rule 1.13 might require you to become a whistleblower. And hopefully that's not something that comes up too often, but if it does, you'll want to seek the guidance of Rule 1.13. And when those situations arise, keep in mind that Rule 1.6 says it is an exception to confidentiality when you seek legal advice to deal with what your obligations are. So in that case, I would, you know, maybe talk to the state bar or talk to a trusted colleague, try to figure out what you should do. Make sure that person is an attorney, though, because we had an interesting case in Minnesota a few years ago where an attorney got fired for being a whistleblower. And in Minnesota, there's a statute that says you can sue if you get fired for being a whistleblower. And the Minnesota Supreme Court was a little bit troubled with that, with an attorney suing their former client. But on the other hand, he fits squarely within the statute. So they were about to grudgingly give him, uphold the verdict that he got against his employer. But they threw his case out because he had gone to his father asking for advice on how to deal with this whistleblower dilemma that he had. And his father wasn't an attorney, so they kind of threw his case out because he had violated the client confidentiality. So when you seek that outside legal advice, you don't just have to go to a smart person, you do have to go to a lawyer to get that. Rule 1.18 talks about your duties to a prospective client, and a prospective client is somebody who communicates with you toward the end of forming an attorney-client relationship. And Rule 1.18 says that that conversation is just as confidential as if they had been an actual client. So in other words, if I come into your office and start blurting out information purportedly because I want to hire you, and you don't want to take my case, you want to take the case of the guy who's suing me, well, unfortunately, there's kind of an unjust result, but I can keep you off the case by engaging in that tactic. That rule is tempered slightly because even though you can't take the case against me because I blurted out all this information, the other attorneys in your office probably can, as long as you took reasonable precautions to try to keep me from blurting out that information. But in general, you can't. Evaluation for use by third parties. If I'm writing an opinion letter on behalf of my client, or maybe just informally giving an opinion to a third party, you know, so my client hires me because they're getting a loan from the bank and they need an opinion letter from the attorney saying that yes, my client is duly incorporated in the state of Minnesota. So I would normally write down, you know, so dear bank, you know, my client, I checked the records of the Minnesota Secretary of State. My client really is incorporated here. So if they hire me to do that, obviously that's an appropriate thing for me to do. But the rule makes clear that if before I give negative information in that evaluation, I have to make sure my client knows that it's going to be negative information. So before sitting down to write an opinion letter to the bank saying, dear bank, it looks like you shouldn't give the loan to my client because it turns out their incorporation expired last year and they're no longer duly incorporated in Minnesota. So, don't give them the loan. Well, before I send that kind of an opinion letter, I better run that past my client and make sure that they want it written that way. If you're ever serving as a arbitrator or mediator under Rule 2.4, you have a kind of an affirmative obligation to explain to the people there that you are not their lawyer. If you think there's any possibility that they misunderstand what your role is, Rule 5.7, that's in the materials. We kind of talked about that yesterday, saying that. You know, even though you might be doing things where the rules apply to you, well, other non-attorneys might be able to do exactly the same thing, yet the rules do not apply to them. So, for example, tax preparation. If you work for H&R Block and you're not an attorney, well, you don't have to worry about conflicts of interest or client confidentiality or anything. You're not going to get disbarred for violating the rules for doing that. But if you're an attorney doing tax preparation, well, those rules might still apply to you. If what you are doing is not distinct from the practice of law, or if the people have any reason to believe that you are acting as an attorney. So if I just anonymously get a job at H&R Block doing tax returns for people and they don't even know I'm a lawyer, well, I'm probably not going to get into trouble for the breaching my obligations as an attorney. But if I have the Clem Law Office / tax preparation business, well, then those people are probably going to be treated as clients, as if they were my legal clients, and the full protections would apply. I'll just wrap up by quoting a rule that's not in the materials. I think it's Rule 8.7, because a lot of times attorneys are admitted in more than one state, and as we see, for like that Iowa rule about divorces, that applies in Iowa, it doesn't apply in other states. What are the choice of law rules? What if there's a difference between the rules in different states? Or, like Minnesota versus Wisconsin and drafting wills for naming yourself as a beneficiary. Well, the general rule is that if you're admitted in just one state, then that's the state's rules that you have to worry about. But if you're admitted in more than one state, the kind of the default rule is, first of all, if you're in court, then the rules of that state apply. But in general, if you're admitted in more than one state, the default rule would be the rule in the state where you have your principal place of business. So if you have if you're admitted in both Minnesota and Wisconsin, but your main office or your only office is in Wisconsin, well, then most of the time Wisconsin law would apply, even if there's a different Minnesota provision, unless that particular conduct has its predominant effect in Minnesota. So if you were, if it's a Minnesota case that you have pending in Minnesota court, and it's a Minnesota resident that you're representing, well, then what you do in that case is probably governed by Minnesota law, whereas normally just in the absence of anything to the contrary, the Wisconsin law would apply. And then finally, before I wrap up here, I should give that last promised code word to make sure everybody gets their full CLE credit. And the third and final code word for this portion of the program is E879, E879, E879 is the last code word for today's program. So with that, I will thank you for attending, both the live takers and the persons on the conference call. Or on the podcast. I'll pause here for any questions in the live program. If you do have any questions, either regarding the live program or the podcast, you can feel free to call or email those with me. Email is always the fastest, to clem.law@usa.net, and I will answer those questions in the time specified in the rules, which usually means the same day. So if you do have any questions, just email them to me at clem.law@usa.net, and that's also the address to send those code numbers to that I've been giving during the course of the program. So thank you once again for joining me, and I look forward to seeing you all at future programs.